This is VOA News. Via remote, I'm Tommy McNeil. Ukraine's president says that a recent attack on Desna killed 87 people. More from AP correspondent Mike Gracia.
Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky says an attack by Russian forces on the town of Desna last week resulted in 87 deaths. In his nightly video address Monday, Zelensky said the deaths and destruction in Desna was caused by only four missiles. According to Zelensky, since February 24th, Russian forces have launched 1,474 missile strikes on Ukraine, with the vast majority hitting civilian targets. At the United Nations Monday, the United States and Britain accused Russia of spreading disinformation about the war online, while Russia's ambassador accused the U.S. and Britain of building a cyber totalitarianism. I'm Mike Gracia.
The World Food Program is warning of a catastrophic failure in food supply chains, which could lead to starvation and global instability. Known as the breadbasket of Europe, Ukraine has over 25 million tons of grain that cannot be exported due to Russia's blockade of its Black Sea ports. More from VOA's Henry Rick.
And they say in the coming months, if this grain doesn't get out, we're going to see an even greater increase in food prices, which are already skyrocketing. And that could send hundreds of millions of people around the world into food insecurity, into poverty, and into starvation. A very stark warning at Davos, a great contrast really to the billionaire image of the World Economic Forum itself. A stark warning that millions face starvation unless this food can be released and those ports are allowed to be unblockaded and the food is released into the global food supply.
That's VOA's Henry Ridgewell reporting. There is more at voanews.com. This is VOA News. Nearly 50 defense leaders from around the world met Monday and agreed to send more advanced weapons to Ukraine, including a harpoon launcher and missiles to protect its coast. VOA's Carla Babb tells us that U.S. General Mark Milley, chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, said that the low-level discussion is underway on how the U.S. may need to adjust its training of Ukrainian forces on whether some U.S. troops should be based in Ukraine.
And the reason why the entire world cares about this is because he says everyone here understands the stakes of this war. They stretch far beyond Europe. General Milley pointed out that the bullying cannot go on without the U.S. support. And so they would continue to support that.
That is VOA's Carla Babb reporting. A Russian soldier who pleaded guilty to killing a Ukrainian civilian was sentenced to life in prison. That sentencing Monday comes amid signs the Kremlin may hold trials of its own, particularly against the captured Ukrainian fighters who held out at Mariupol's steel plant. The United States and Britain are accusing Russia of spreading disinformation online and manipulating public opinion about the war in Ukraine and rejecting Russian claims that the West is aiming to control all information flows and define what is true or not true. Britain's deputy ambassador, James Ruskell, told a UN Security Council meeting on the use of digital technologies and maintaining peace that Russia has conducted cyber attacks and used an online troll factory to spread disinformation on and manipulate public opinion about the war. The U.S. Ambassador Linda Thomas-Greenfield said the Russian government continues to shut down, restrict and degrade internet connectivity, censor content, spread disinformation online, and intimidate and arrest journalists for reporting the truth about its invasion. The U.N. envoy for Somalia urged the country Monday to build on last week's election of a new president and work on national reconciliation, improve relations between the central governments and states, and confront the growing threat from the Al-Shabaab extremist group. James Swan called last week's conclusion of Somalia's unduly protracted and contentious electoral process a major milestone for the country and told the UN Security Council it's past time for leaders to address those and other pressing issues. Meta, the parent company of Facebook and Instagram, said it will start publicly providing more details about how advertisers target people with political ads. It is acting just months before the U.S. midterm elections and years after criticism the social media platforms withhold too much information around how campaigns, special interest groups, and politicians target small pockets of people. Recapping our top story, Ukraine's president says a recent attack on Desna killed 87 people. Via remote, I'm Tommy McNeil, VOA News.
Today is Tuesday, May 24th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I am Chinedu in Washington. Coming up in the next half hour, U.S. President Joe Biden takes assertive stance towards China as he continues tour of Asia.
China has been a focus of Biden's stop in Tokyo, and on more than just military issues. On Monday, Biden unveiled the beginnings of an initiative meant to demonstrate U.S. economic engagement in Asia.
20 countries announced new security assistance for Ukraine as fighting intensifies with Russian forces.
Russia's unprovoked and cruel invasion has galvanized countries from around the world. And the bravery, the skill, and the grit of the Ukrainian people have inspired people everywhere.
And scientists seek to understand the origins of monkeypox amid fears of a global outbreak. We'll have these stories and more next on International Edition. Stay tuned. U.S. President Joe Biden took an assertive stance towards China as he continued his two-country tour of Northeast Asia on Monday. It's part of an effort to demonstrate the U.S. is committed both economically and militarily to the region, as VOA's Bill Gallo reports from Seoul, South Korea.
Alongside his Japanese counterpart in Tokyo, Joe Biden gave a direct answer when asked if the U.S. would defend Taiwan in the event of a Chinese invasion.
Yes.
You are.
That's the commitment we made. That's the commitment we made.
It's Biden's latest move away from the strategic ambiguity the U.S. has long adopted on the issue. China views democratic Taiwan as a breakaway province and vows to retake it by force if necessary. Its foreign ministry condemned Biden's comments. China has been a focus of Biden's stop in Tokyo and on more than just military issues. On Monday, Biden unveiled the beginnings of an initiative meant to demonstrate U.S. economic engagement in Asia. So far, 12 Asian countries have agreed to join the talks. An impressive figure, says Derek Grossman of the RAND Corporation.
I think the administration did a pretty good job, to be honest, to get a wide array of different countries with different economic systems, different political systems, on board for IPEF.
But critics say there isn't yet enough substance to the framework and point out it's not binding.
On the other side of the ledger, the Chinese are certainly codifying those arrangements. And that I think is problematic when the U.S. is not doing so. If we're in this quote-unquote extreme competition with China, what they're doing is not what we're doing. And it seems like they're doing a better job of it.
Before Biden heads home, on Tuesday, he'll participate in a meeting of the Quad, a regional grouping of democracies that is widely seen, in part, as an attempt to contain China. Bill Gallo, VOA News, Seoul, South Korea.
The Chinese Foreign Ministry on Monday expressed, quote, strong dissatisfaction and resolute opposition, unquote, to President Joe Biden's remarks that the U.S. would intervene militarily if China were to invade Taiwan. The ministry spokesperson Wang Wenbin said, quote, China has no room for compromise or concessions on issues involving China's core interests, such as sovereignty and territorial integrity, unquote. He added that, quote, China would take firm action to safeguard its sovereignty and security interests, and in his words, quote, we'll do what we say, unquote. Biden's statement was one of the most forceful presidential statements in support of self-governing in decades. A White House official said Biden's comments do not reflect a policy shift. South Korea's new conservative president, Yoon Suk-yeol, has signaled a hardline posture against North Korea. He said the days of appeasing Pyongyang is over as Seoul strengthens defense pact with Washington. Suk-yeol said any further talks on reducing tensions in the peninsula will have to be initiated by Kim Jong-un. Analysts fear a looming confrontation with the unpredictable North Korean leader, who has fired more than a dozen missiles within the past month. Here again is VOA Seoul Bureau Chief Bill Gallo.
North Korea does not seem interested in talks at the moment, whether that's because of the coronavirus or whether it's because it just wants to be able to build up more leverage and develop better weapons before re-entering talks. We really don't know, but it seems that for now, talks are not on the agenda with North Korea.
We know that North Korea is not interested in talks, and new South Korean president said he's not going to push for one. So what happens in the peninsula? Where does this lead?
We can be pretty confident that North Korea will test more weapons in the coming days. They have many reasons to do it. And it goes beyond just sort of sending a message to the United States or getting the attention of the world, which is sometimes what global media focus on. I think a major reason North Korea will continue to test weapons is because it wants to develop bigger weapons. It wants to develop more of a deterrent, and it wants to be able to get enough weapons to make it so where there's a dynamic where it can threaten South Korea and other allies with a credible nuclear threat. South Korea also will test weapons, to be frank. They have really, really intensified their weapons development over the last several years. That is expected to continue. You have an arms race in Korea. It's not clear where, you know, that standoff sort of will end, but both sides of the Korean Peninsula are developing bigger and better weapons, really at an alarming pace.
What was it like when the president was in town, especially with the assessment of the U.S. intelligence, that missiles might go off, even including a nuclear missile test, when President Biden was in town?
In the lead up to Biden's visit, U.S. and South Korean officials both said very often they think there's a great possibility that North Korea will conduct either a long-range missile test or a nuclear test. They were sort of ready to be able to adjust their schedule if that happens. So far, we have not seen a test. It still could happen, though, while the president is in Japan. I would say that there was not really a sense of tensions, only because, you know, most South Koreans are really used to missile tests. I mean, we've had 16 already this year. We've had really hundreds and hundreds of missile tests in recent years. It's not as if there were a sense of fear, but I think that both the U.S. and South Korea sides were sort of really sending a public message that they're ready to deal with this if North Korea were to escalate via a missile test. I would say also that the U.S. and South Korea are finding a lot of common ground on this issue right now. The new South Korean president is conservative. Conservatives are more explicitly pro-alliance with the U.S. This really gives them a lot of common ground and a lot of maneuvering space in the days forward regarding the North Korean issue.
North Korea, from every available evidence, is facing its own surge of COVID-19. President Biden and the West are promising some kind of assistance, especially going through China. But there's tension there. Are they ready to accept any assistance? And how bad, really, is the COVID surge?
Frankly, we're hearing nothing from North Korea about whether it will accept any outside help for the coronavirus. The U.S. and South Korea have repeatedly offered help, such as vaccines and treatment and other medical aid. But really, North Korea hasn't responded. There were reports that last week North Korea did send some cargo planes to pick up medical supplies from China. We don't know what was in there.
That's VOA Seoul Bureau Chief Bill Gallo speaking with me from Seoul. U.S. Defense Secretary Lloyd Austin said some 220 countries had announced new security assistance packages for Ukraine during a virtual meeting with allies on Monday that was aimed at coordinating arms for Kyiv. Austin told reporters following a meeting of the Ukraine Defense Contact Group that the countries that announced new packages include Italy, Denmark, Greece, Norway, and Poland. Austin said Denmark would provide a Harpoon launcher and missiles to defend Ukraine's coast.
Russia's unprovoked and cruel invasion has galvanized countries from around the world. And the bravery, the skill, and the grit of the Ukrainian people have inspired people everywhere. Now, we've made important progress since the contact group was established after the Rammstein summit last month. And today, together with Minister Reznikov and his team, we've gained a sharper and shared sense of Ukraine's priority requirements and the situation on the battlefield. We also heard some very welcome announcements this morning about even more security assistance for Ukraine. Many countries are donating critically needed artillery ammunition, coastal defense systems, and tanks and other armored vehicles. Others came forward with new commitments for training Ukraine's forces and sustaining its military systems.
That's U.S. Defense Secretary Lloyd Austin. Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky told world leaders and business executives at the World Economic Forum in Davos Monday that they face a turning point following Russia's invasion of his country, and said it was time to ratchet up sanctions against Moscow. Henry Ridgewell reports.
It is the first time world and business leaders have gathered at Davos since January 2020, before the coronavirus pandemic. It is a changed world. Among the first leaders to address delegates by video link was Ukraine's President Volodymyr Zelensky, dressed not in the uniform of the Davos elite, but the army fatigues of a wartime leader. He demanded maximum sanctions on Russia. An embargo on Russian oil, he said. A complete blockade of all Russian banks without exception. Total abandonment of the Russian IT sector and complete cessation of trade with the aggressor. Do not wait for fatal shots, President Zelensky said. Do not wait for Russia's use of special weapons, chemical, biological, or, God forbid, nuclear. Ukraine has sent a large delegation to Davos, including the mayor of Kiev, Vitaly Klitschko.
Every one of you have to understand, we're defending you personally. We're fighting for values. I hope we same values, democratic values.
The Ukrainian delegation has been warmly welcomed, but their demands for a complete embargo on Russian energy and trade are far from being met. Germany continues to import Russian gas, as does Hungary, which is resisting efforts towards an EU-wide embargo on Russian oil imports. Robert Habeck is the German economy minister and vice chancellor.
I expect everyone, also Hungary, that they work to find a solution and not saying, OK, we have an exception and then we will lay back and build on our partnership with Putin.
Some business leaders said isolating Russia would take time. Ben Smit is from McKinsey & Company in the Netherlands.
This is a fight that we can't fully participate in, but we're trying to do our best. I think that's a little bit how it feels. But you feel a little helpless if you stand there and see what the Ukrainians have to do for us to stand for our values and to stand for our lives.
Russian delegates haven't been invited. Instead, the former Russia House in Davos has been transformed into what's been dubbed the Russian War Crimes House, depicting alleged atrocities carried out by the Kremlin's forces. Bjorn Geldof is the curator of the exhibition.
Here in Davos, say, the world's most powerful people come together, and through them we also have to show who is suffering and why they are suffering.
Many of the 2,000 delegates at Davos have voiced strong condemnation of Russia's invasion and support for Ukraine. But it remains to be seen whether this Alpine gathering will result in any further economic pressure on Moscow. Henry Ridgewell for VOA News, London.
A state security official in Ethiopia's northern Amhara region say more than 4,000 people have been arrested, including 200 for alleged killings. David Doyle of Reuters has more.
Ethiopian authorities have arrested more than 4,000 people in the northern Amhara region, local state media said on Monday, as part of a wider crackdown against militia fighters, critics and the press. Gizatu Mulune, spokesperson for the Amhara Regional Administration and federal government spokesperson Ligese Tulu, did not immediately respond to requests for comment on the wave of arrests. Amhara state security official Desalegn Tasu told the Amhara Media Corporation that more than 200 of the suspects were accused of killings. He alleged they had conducted illegal activities in the name of the Fano paramilitary group. It was not clear why the rest were being detained. Amhara forces and the Fano militia backed federal troops against rebellious forces in the Tigray region after fighting erupted there in November 2020. However, relations between some top Amhara officials and central government have since soured. Tasu did not provide any evidence to back up the accusations of killings, and Reuters could not independently verify the claims. On Sunday, a US-based online media outlet said four employees had been arrested in Amhara, while the whereabouts of two others were unclear. That would add to the reported arrests of five journalists at another Amhara media outlet on Thursday. Critics say Prime Minister Abiy Ahmed is cracking down on dissent around Ethiopia. He says he's guaranteeing stability and law and order in the multi-ethnic nation.
That's David Doyle of Reuters. In other news, the World Health Organization said on Monday it expects to identify more cases of monkeypox as it expands surveillance in countries where the disease is not typically found. The WHO also said it does not have evidence that the monkeypox virus has mutated. Rosamund Lewis is the head of the Smallpox Secretariat, which is part of the WHO Emergencies Program. She said that mutations are typically lower with the virus, although genome sequencing of cases will help inform understanding of the current outbreak. She said more than 100 suspected and confirmed cases in the outbreak in Europe and North America have not been severe. The outbreaks are atypical, according to the WHO, as they are occurring in countries where the virus does not regularly circulate. Scientists are seeking to understand the origin of the cases and whether anything about the virus has changed. For more on this story and other breaking news, visit our website at voaafrica.com. Remember to connect with us on social media. We are on Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram. Search for VOA Africa. The violence may have stopped in most parts of Ethiopia's Afar region, but Afaris forced to leave their homes after Tigrayan forces occupied the region say they cannot return, and it's not just Tigrayan civilians who are affected by the conflict. Displaced people from the neighboring Afar region say attacks on their towns have left homes and livelihoods utterly destroyed. Linda Giftash reports from Semera, Ethiopia.
Roughly 700,000 people have been displaced in Ethiopia's Afar region following violence tied to the civil conflict in the Tigray region, according to the United Nations. The Afar region had long-standing close ties with the Tigray region, so when forces aligned with the Tigray People's Liberation Front attacked, residents were taken by surprise. Halima Tahir Ismail is a displaced Afari living at a camp 100 kilometers from the region's capital of Semera. She says she was asleep when she heard shots from heavy machine guns. She and her family woke up in a war zone. She says husbands and children were scattered. People fled their homes because of the heavy fighting. Ismail says she fled with three of her children, all under the age of five, with nothing but the clothes on their backs. They, like other displaced people, now rely on food aid. She's heard from those who stayed in the Afar region where the Tigrayan forces attacked and that the grocery store she owned was ransacked and destroyed, as was her family's home in Konaba. She asks, how can they go back to Konaba? If they return, she says there is no water, property, and household utilities like furniture were looted. Ismail says whether you were well off like herself or poor before the war, now everyone has been left equally impoverished. Valerie Browning, a nurse and volunteer in the region for over 30 years, visited northern communities of Afar days after troops pulled out in April, a condition of which warring groups agreed to allow humanitarian aid.
The destruction is absolutely systematic. It is house by house that they looted, house by house for the civilians. They've looted everything. And institution, the government institutions, they either burnt them, exploded them, or they tore out all the machinery, all the technical stuff, and just ripped it apart.
The World Food Program and other humanitarian groups are distributing food and other aid, but it has been a challenge to reach everyone in the remote and rough terrain. While the WFP has given aid to 630,000 people, the total number of people in need tops 1.3 million, more than half the region's population. Linda Giftash for VOA News, Semera, Ethiopia.
The most devastating impact of a deadly heat wave that has racked India for more than 2 months is felt by people who walk outdoors in its vast cities. From New Delhi, Anjana Patricia reports on the hardships such extreme climate events are having on vulnerable populations.
Pradeep Kumar can earn nearly $8 daily with the traditional cold drink that he makes at his cart in a popular market in New Delhi. Supposed to cool the body, the beverage has been much in demand since a brutal heat wave gripped India early in March. But the unrelenting heat takes its toll on the young worker.
I am exhausted every night after standing under the sun. Sometimes I fall sick due to the heat, and then I need to rest for a few days.
Kumar is not the only one bearing the brunt of income loss due to high temperatures. Between 2001 and 2020, India lost about 100 billion hours of labor per year, costing the country's economy billions of dollars, according to a Duke University study. The most severe impact is on people who work outdoors, at construction sites or in markets where concrete buildings and roads trap the heat. Divyanshu Pratap, who has been working at a pavement stall since he came from his village in March, knows it firsthand.
When I am working, the sun blazes on my head and I get dizzy spells. Then I feel weak and fall down.
The heat waves are a huge health hazard. With no place to shelter, most of these workers cannot heed a government advisory to avoid being outdoors between noon and 3 p.m. Laborers toiled at construction sites, even as temperatures soared above 45 degrees Celsius on many days in the past weeks. This rickshaw puller ferries customers over short distances but needs to rest frequently. The plight of these workers could worsen amid warnings that climate change will result in more frequent heat waves in the coming years. Anjana Pasricha for VOA News, New Delhi.
Thank you, Anjana. To all our VOA listeners, please note we have moved our programs to a new website, voaafrica.com, from voanews.com. There you will find all your favorite VOA radio and TV programs and a whole lot more. Find us on voaafrica.com, and thanks for listening. And this has been International Edition on The Voice of America. On behalf of the entire production team, thank you so much for listening. Visit our website for in-depth coverage of world events and news 24 hours a day at voaafrica.com. Until next time, I am Junior Dofo in Washington. Have a great day.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
The United States strongly condemns the arrests by Hong Kong authorities of 90-year-old Cardinal Joseph Zen, the former Catholic Bishop of Hong Kong and outspoken critic of the Chinese Communist Party, and three other prominent pro-democracy advocates, Margaret Ng, a lawyer and former legislator, Hoi Po Kung, a scholar and former professor, and Denise Ho, an actress and singer. The four were trustees of the now-dissolved 612 Humanitarian Relief Fund, which was established in 2019 to provide financial and legal assistance to those who participated in pro-democracy demonstrations in Hong Kong. They were falsely charged and arrested on May 11th for colluding with foreign forces and subsequently released on bail, but could face sentences of life imprisonment. State Department spokesperson Ned Price said, in arresting these veteran activists, scholars, and religious leaders under the so-called national security law, Hong Kong authorities have again demonstrated that they will pursue all means necessary to stifle dissent and undercut protected rights and freedoms. Then White House Principal Deputy Press Secretary Karine Jean-Pierre called on PRC and Hong Kong authorities to cease targeting Hong Kong's advocates, noting that freedom of expression is critical to prosperous and secure societies. Over the past several years, Beijing has been increasing its control over Hong Kong, arresting democracy activists, shuttering civil society groups, and forcing independent media organizations to close. The PRC has increasingly violated the fundamental freedoms of the people of Hong Kong that were guaranteed in the Basic Law and in the Sino-British Joint Declaration when control of Hong Kong was transferred from Britain to the People's Republic of China in 1997. The arrests come just days after the only Chinese Communist Party-approved candidate for the Hong Kong chief executive position, former Hong Kong security chief John Lee Kak-chew, took office. After his so-called election, the foreign ministers of the G7 countries, which include Canada, France, Germany, Italy, Japan, the United Kingdom, and the United States, published a statement expressing grave concern over the selection process for the chief executive in Hong Kong, as part of a continued assault on political pluralism and fundamental freedoms. We continue to call on China, they declared, to act in accordance with the Sino-British Joint Declaration and its other legal obligations.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.